And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
The last days of October bring the sudden changes in the weather. One day it's 56, and the next it's the first snowfall of the season. And in a great stroke of irony, yet another hurricane is making eyes towards Central America. The changing winds of autumn. We've got plenty to talk about and lots to remember when the voice of the earth returns here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
This is our first ever Friday edition of the Wildside News. Thanks for tuning in. I just returned from Washington, D.C. It's always an amazing place to visit. I walked all around the seats of power and had time to explore before heading back. Almost all of the museums in the nation's capital are free to the public, so I had plenty to choose from. But when all was said and done, I ended up at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. I have some thoughts about that. And then we take a look at a brand new magazine that brings a whole new look to the holistic way of life. We'll talk with the editor of Plenty Magazine, Mark Spellen. Then we go in-depth with Vice Admiral Dennis McGinn, who zeroes in on America's future energy needs. It's a perspective we all need to hear. Then in segment three, it's a reflection on some of the best voices of the earth from previous shows. It is amazing what our wonderful guests bring you each week. It's a great show, but I want to take us back to the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. It's no secret I'm a natural history museum junkie. Every time I enter one, I suddenly want to forget about everything else I think I should do and just spend all of my life studying the wonders of the earth. There's one thing to be sure about at the Smithsonian's Natural History Museum. It has some of the best of the best. It's done with great wisdom. You learn as you make your way through the exhibits. I didn't have all that much time, so I decided to start at the beginning and make my way through, tracing time and the evolutionary changes that quite literally brought me to this place. So I entered the ancient Seas Hall, and then something happened. Looking at hundreds of specimens of ancient shells, seeing the beauty of their forms, I had to wonder why life managed to come in this way to planet Earth. As I continued through the exhibit halls, life appeared more diverse and larger and more complex over millions of years. The ancient seas open into the Hall of the Dinosaurs, where life-sized specimens traced the emergence of the walking beasts, and then on to the flying beasts and tales of the warm earth and the fecundity of life abundant. And then the collapse, when, as recorded in ancient rock strata from New Mexico, the giant beasts vanished. But a wonderful display revealed the evidence now confirmed of a giant asteroid that smacked into the Gulf of Mexico, rattling all things earthly, sending a tsunami a mile high out and over the lands, scouring the earth to bare rock, starting fires in the higher grounds, creating smoke that obliterated the sun, and eliminated a stream of creative evolution, which ultimately may have helped we uprights have a chance. I also visited the gem and mineral exhibits, as I am always transformed by looking at transparent mysteries of color and form that the universe is compelled to express. I wish I had the rest of my life to study and think about how the elements add a single electron and proton, and suddenly a whole new form of truth is revealed. Hydrogen to helium. One explodes, the next won't. Or carbon, the black, smudgy element, which when compressed with heat turns into a diamond. And the carbon is ranked next to nitrogen and then oxygen, from solid to gas, with a single additional proton and electron. In many ways, these are the many facets of truth. And our little planet in the universe is filled with such gems and wonders, not to mention gold and copper, uranium and plutonium, and then on to the hall of the mammals, with the tigers and zebras, giraffes and meadow voles, and the chimps and gibbons and orangutans and gorillas, which we now hear are likely to disappear from the list of miraculous living gifts of life. If ever you should find yourself unsure about our Earth or our future, visit the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, spend some time, and it will snap you back into a sense of mission to fight to never ever let it go. So now, the news. This weekend, planet Mars will be the closest it's been in 60,000 years, a mere 43.1 million miles rather than the usual 140 million miles. So when you wake up to change your clocks back to regular time on Saturday night, take a peek to the heavens and see our solar system's red planet. Up to half of the world's coral reefs will disappear by 2045 unless urgent measures are taken to protect them against environmental hazards. 20% of the Earth's coral reefs have been effectively destroyed today, says Carl Gustav Lundin, head of the World Conservation Union, and another 30% will become seriously depleted if no action is taken within the next 20 to 40 years, with climate change being a major factor for loss. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reported Tuesday that a major coral bleaching event is underway in the Caribbean and may result in significant coral death in much of the region. The WFU said marine parks reduce the stress on coral reef ecosystems and therefore recommended a strategy for the establishment of a global marine park network. In Canberra, Australia, about 130 pilot whales died after three pods became stranded on a remote beach in southern Australia. Long-finned pilot whales are medium-sized whales, reaching up to about 20 feet in length. A group of 70 long-finned pilot whales beached themselves in the same location in 1998, leading some conservationists to speculate that some strandings may be caused by military sonar devices that emit sound waves, potentially shattering the eardrums of the long-finned pilot whales and disorienting them. And scientists have now announced that they finally have proof that chimpanzees communicate, that is, talk, to one another about objects in their environment. Chimps at the Edinburgh Zoo in Scotland use a crude language of grunts to talk to each other about their food, say primate experts at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. The chimps utter high-pitched noises or low-pitched grunts to tell each other about the food they find in their pen. Scientists recorded grunts and played them to a chimp in the pen. When the chimp heard the bread grunt, the ape looked in the place in the pen where bread is usually found. Critics of the announcement point out in amazement that it has taken researchers this long to come to this discovery. The recent spate of hurricanes is being used as an excuse to extend natural gas drilling on federal public lands in Wyoming to a year-round schedule. The region is expected to receive an increase in drilling applications of 32% over last year. The rising cost of natural gas is pushing such a change. This extended push for drilling on public lands is expected to increase the demand of such on more extensive tracts of America's open spaces. And that's the news. So now, let's turn to our first feature. We keep talking about change. It is everywhere. And recently, when I attended the Green Festival in Washington, D.C., I talked with the editor and publisher of a new magazine that is changing the look and feel of green.
So much of what all of us on this planet are trying to do, who care and are working to make a sustainable future for us all, which is so critical right now because so many things on this planet are telling us there's something that's not quite right.
And I'd have to live in a tree, so to speak, to not notice it, right?
So to try to help get that message out, which is what the Wild Side News is doing, all sorts of people as well are really stepping up to the media, because the media is so critical. And right now joining me is Mark Spellen, who's the editor-in-chief and publisher of Plenty Magazine. First of all, Mark, where are you from?
I'm from New York. I launched Plenty a year ago, back in November, so we're just... Our sixth issue just hit the newsstand now. We're bi-monthly. But basically, Plenty is an environmental lifestyle magazine that's really trying to bring green to the mainstream. And that, you know, we're writing about green culture, but, you know, trying to reach to a broader audience. It's fun, it's hip, it's irreverent.
Part of your mission is to try to drag this out of sort of the, nothing wrong with the backwoods or the backcountry and alternatives, but really into the mainstream. Why do you think that's so important?
Well, I mean, there's a certain percentage of the population that's already leading an incredibly committed and in tune with nature lifestyle, but progress is only made as you convert more people. So we're, you know, trying to reach out to that broader group that, you know, they could be leading a harried life in the suburbs, you know, family of four, you know, mom, dad commuting, but they can really make only incremental changes in their lives. So we offer tips on better living, whether it's, you know, we're all about incremental changes. So whether it's getting a hybrid car, getting a smaller car than an SUV, whatever, buying organic milk. So we offer those tips, but also big think pieces on the environment and society.
Well, here's one thing I noticed right off the bat, and that this doesn't have the usual look of kind of a an alternative publication. If I saw this on a news rack, I think everybody in the whole world would be interested in it. Well, how'd you get the name Plenty? That's kind of interesting.
In our mission statement, we said, if we make the right choices, we can have a world of plenty. There's only so much oil underground, but there's unlimited wind, unlimited solar. So we really believe that you can live well, but also do good by the earth. So we're about talking about those different options that are available to us.
I'm tired of apologizing or in any way suggesting that somehow that what we're suggesting isn't anything but mainstream.
Right.
I mean, I'm really kind of worn out doing that.
Well, I think the big question today is, like, have we even reached the tipping point? You know, they talk about where a trend or an item just reaches this critical scale, and then it's all of a sudden it's everywhere. And I think in some ways it has. Like, if the largest corporation in America, GE, is branding itself as green, and not just, you know, associating itself, but actually is saying they're doing substantive changes, or if the coolest car in the market is not the Hummer, but is the Prius. You could argue that it is, you know, there. It's difficult, I think, to integrate every aspect of your life and make it green. It's still a challenge. I mean, you have to take a few steps. You know, you have to be conscious about it. But there's certainly lots of options around for you to pursue.
When people come in to your magazine, your Plenty magazine, for example, I'm looking at the cover. And I'm just going to go through this because I'm coming to this a little bit. Can we buy a healthy planet? That's an interesting concept. 10 wildlife adventures, not business as usual. GE, Walmart, McDonald's, sell green. This sounds pretty mainstream. How do you find your writers and how do you choose your topics?
We bandy around ideas in editorial meetings. I mean, in some ways, you know, we have a very targeted magazine, and that we are, I mean, we're not appealing to everyone, certainly. So in some ways, I think we're offering unique kind of content, and so these writers kind of find us. They want to write it that are frustrated with, you know, whether they work for the LA Times or New York Times, whatever, but they have a story for us that's right for us. So,
for example, I open this up and I see the owner of Cliff Bars.
Right, and the green business. We have an advertisement here for the upcoming Green Business Conference in San Francisco in the beginning of November, which is for a lot of the green business leaders today, whether from Cliff Bar, Seventh Generation, will be there, you know, talking about our sustainable future.
So you get a chance to meet some of these folks and talk with them, some of the leaders, and particularly in this green industry.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think? How are they talking these days? These guys and women are out there doing this. What are you hearing?
Well, I think a lot of them are pretty incredible people. I mean, I haven't met them all, but, you know, companies like Seventh Generation are becoming more visible today, but they've been at this for 20 years, 30 years. I mean, they've been struggling a long, you know, time, and they're sort of, I think they're all very committed people themselves, too, whether the CEO from Patagonia, it's really, it is a part of their life.
Well, and then Plenty Magazine helps to really bring them all together. So it's similar to what the Wild Side News is trying to do, which is to create a place where people can come and find this and find really their community. But the community is becoming very, very, very large.
One thing you alluded to before, and that it, I think you were saying the magazine appears like, it could be a normal magazine on the newsstand, and that, you know, another way to refer to it is it's a green glossy. I mean, we deliberately, in our choice of look, you know, we just wanted to say that, you know, green can also be fashionable. There's, like, high fashions. You don't have to necessarily sacrifice what you think of as your personal style. There's a whole range. You know, there is no one way to be green, I guess.
In terms of your audience, green used to be associated with kind of older people.
Yeah.
How are you addressing that?
Well, we're writing the magazine pretty young, if you read it, and 75% of our readers are under 40. Modern environmentalism, I think, was born in the early 60s. But there's a new generation today, and it's just always been a part of their life, I think. You know, teenagers or people in their 20s, it's just really a fabric, and so it's incredibly important to them.
Now, personally, from your own perspective, what is it that brought you to this endeavor?
Well, I guess, I come from a journalism background and more policy background. I worked in Washington for a while out of college, so I've always been involved with, you know, what I think of as doing the right thing. I haven't been an environmental activist per se, but in some ways I'm a mainstream person, I guess, in some ways. And so it just, on one hand, things seem terribly wrong, and that we weren't broader policy-wise, we weren't addressing some of the critical issues. I mean, if everything was heading in the right direction, then, you know, whatever, just go about your life, right? but I didn't really think that was the case. And so on one hand, I think there was a certain call to action, but on another hand, I didn't think there was, the Puente's voice was out there, and it just sort of seemed to me that there was a need for it.
Now, is this available generally across around the nation?
Yeah, we're available nationally, Barnes & Noble, Borders, Whole Foods, Wild Oats, Albertsons. You can't find us in every store, but you may have to do a little looking, but we're getting out there.
And for people who want to find you on the web, where do they do that?
www.plentymag.com.
As you look up into the future of Plenty Magazine, where would you like this to go?
We're just trying to build consumer brand awareness, get the word out there. We're still finishing up our first year, so a lot of people don't know about us yet. Yeah, so we just trying to reach out there and hopefully strike a chord.
So much of what we're all trying to do is not just about selling stuff. It's really about it's about living a lifestyle that, in the process, creates sustainability, and we can use our choices to help support that. If we buy right, and we buy wisely, then we're actually investing in our future. And I have to assume that to a large extent, the various people that you feature in your magazine, both the organizations and the companies, are all part of building that future.
I mean, definitely. I think one of the most powerful things we all can do is just with our buying decisions, right? If you're supporting a forward-thinking, sustainable company, it's big. You're allowing them to succeed, and also you're encouraging other people to do the same, because if that company fails, no one else is going to copy them. There's also a large just cultural element that we try to cover. In the current issue on the newsstand, we talk about critical mass, a nationwide movement that's trying to increase the ability for people to bike around the city. We focus on New York, because they started in a lot of cities, it proceeds relatively peacefully. But since the Republican convention, there's been a confrontation with the police in New York, and they've been trying to stop the protests. So we had a writer, one of our editors actually had been, before she even started working with us, she was a writer with the group. So it's her experiences firsthand with that.
Give me a sense of some of the people some of the organizations that people might find, because obviously some of these are important for people to know about, but as well, they'll be familiar with some of these as well, some of your advertisers and others.
I mean, clearly it's some of the leading green companies, whether it's the Organic Horizons, Seventh Generations of the world, or some of them even on the investment side, whether Domini Social Investments. I mean, there's a huge socially responsible investment is a multi-billion dollar industry these days, and so Domini is one of the leaders, and some of the cell phone companies advertise with us because, one thing, it's actually mandated, I think, that they have to try to collect some of their cell phones, which do pollute. So the batteries cause problems in waste sites. So it's a whole range.
Now, are you a monthly?
Bi-monthly, six times a year. That's how you need to start a magazine. Otherwise, it's a little rough. So.
And what's a subscription run these days?
It's just $12 a year, so $2 an issue. So.
I'm going to subscribe myself, okay, as a matter of fact. And I look forward to seeing what you're doing. And
okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
It takes all kinds for change. In a moment, the view of America's energy future takes on a whole new meaning when we talk with Vice Admiral Dennis McGinn about the future of American security in light of such dependence on foreign oil, when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Everyone listening knows the price that America is paying now, literally, for ignoring the messages over the past 35 years. Oil is running out. And with that comes the enormous jump in the price of gas. It seems somehow some of our politicians wish to play with America's security. But the voices of many now are uniting in amazing new alliances to speak up about the need for a new American energy economy. This is now a matter of the greatest national security. In Washington, D.C., there was a very amazing announcement by a coalition of people involved in the environment and security that normally don't come together and talk about the future of America's environment and energy independence, but they did. And what they are terming this new effort is the Re-Energize America campaign. And one of the key participants and promoters of this is Vice Admiral Dennis McGinn, USN, U.S. Navy retired, who is talking with us now. Are you in D.C.?
I am.
Tell us, first of all, about this event and how it came to be.
It came to be through the auspices of the Natural Resources Defense Council, who had been tracking this whole history of our growing energy dependence and was hearing voices from many, many different sections of society, many different organizations, not the traditional ones that you would think of in the past as being focused on energy and environment, and decided to put together a campaign called Re-Energize America to make sure that people understood that we were facing a national crisis that was growing every day and had aspects of threats to national security, to our economy, to our environment, and in some cases to our way of life.
Give us a broad spectrum about who actually was participating.
Well, we had in this particular event, the kickoff event, we had the Steelworkers of America represented. We had ranchers and, shall we say, stewards of the far west, where a lot of oil and gas exploration is conducted, represented by a sixth generation rancher from New Mexico. We had the evangelical movement represented by Reverend Jim Ball to make the case that this was really an issue of concern to those of faith, and I represented the position, if you will, on national security, the national security aspects of our growing dependence on oil.
Well, Admiral McGinn, you have at times in your life had a terrific amount of responsibility in terms of national security. Give us a brief background about your history.
Well, one of my most enjoyable and at the same time challenging roles was as commander of the U.S. Third Fleet, homeported right there in San Diego aboard the USS Coronado at the time. In that role, I was responsible for the readiness and training of Pacific Fleet carrier battle groups and expeditionary strike groups. and was very, very keenly aware of the kinds of challenges that our sailors and Marines working with their service counterparts might face in all areas of the world. As a result of that, I became very concerned about our growing dependence on oil from parts of the world that weren't very friendly to our core values in the United States. And then I started looking at some of the economic indicators, the tremendous growth of the economies of, in particular, China and in India, and also the growing demand that they had for this critical natural resource of oil.
Give us your assessment of our current situation.
Just briefly, it's we have about anywhere from 2 to 3% of the known world reserves of oil that are in the United States or United States territory. We use 25% of the world's oil that is produced. So this isn't a sustainable situation. If you add to that the fact that there's going to be more competition for oil resources over the next 5 to 10 to 15 years, we have got to do something to ensure that we reduce our dependence on oil in general, but in particular on foreign imported oil, oil from unstable regions of the world.
What is the way forward then for America?
Basically, it's two major components. We can do so much better in terms of the value that we get from every unit of energy that we use. For example, fuel standards for our automobile and our trucking industry. We did tremendously well as a nation when we were faced with the crisis of oil shortages in the 1970s. We've increased our efficiency in terms of energy usage. At the same time, our economy grew. So it isn't a situation where we have to sacrifice our quality of life. We don't have to sacrifice our economy, our the amount of jobs available to us in the challenge of increasing energy efficiency. In fact, by increasing energy efficiency, we can actually increase the robustness of our economy, increase more jobs, and maintain or increase our quality of life. A good example of this has to do with the transportation sector. This consumes about 60% of the energy that we import, and we can do so much better in terms of our choices of the fuel consumption standards that our vehicles use, how we use our vehicles. One of the easiest way to think about this is a typical hybrid, a so-called hybrid automobile. For starters, will double the fuel consumption of an equivalent type of vehicle that is not hybrid. And if you go into the future in the next 5 to 10 years and we start seeing what are called plug-in hybrids and hybrids whose internal combustion engines can run on 85-15 ethanol-gasoline mixes, you can get enormous energy efficiency out of every gallon of gasoline that you put into those vehicles. In our homes, we can do so much more. Most people are familiar with the Energy Star label. I think being selective as consumers in the types of appliances that we buy, how we heat and cool our homes, how we insulate them, we can maintain, as I said, a great quality of life. It isn't a great sacrifice. And the key point to remember here is that this is a pocketbook issue. For every extra dollar that we spend on fuel inefficiency in our cars or in kilowatt hours in our homes, that's money that could be used for so many other uses. And it just makes a lot of sense to make smart choices and ones that do not detract from our quality of life in the least.
You know, to a large extent, there are certainly the correlations to war, that this is a war. We really are struggling at this point to determine our future, and there are a lot of prices that we're paying. You're used to kind of rallying troops and getting them behind this. How do we actually then, therefore, bring this out to the American public to get them involved in this effort?
I think just making them aware of the fact that the choices that we make as Americans, making us all aware of the choices that we make, have a direct effect on our overall economy, and it's not necessarily in the long term, it can be in the very short term. Also, we should understand that when we import the large amount of oil that we do, that that supply could be cut off at any time by a variety of circumstances. Of course, one of the most dramatic would be a terrorist attack on a major oil transshipment point overseas or major oil refining capability. That the consequences economically of that type of a disruption of our oil supply would be very, very dramatic indeed. We would find ourselves looking at gas prices of $2.25 a gallon with nostalgia as the price per barrel of oil went up because of the greatly limited supply due to that disruption of oil and the continuing demand in this country as well as in other countries.
Now, assuming that that doesn't happen, and pretty good, it never does, but if we don't actually then win this war into the future, what are the risks of failure to America?
Economic risk, because every dollar that we spend on energy is a dollar that we're not investing. It's a consumption society. It isn't an investment society. It's a risk of national security in a traditional military sense, in that we make ourselves more and more vulnerable to being held hostage to disruption to the oil supply by some nation or group of nations that's hostile to our national purposes. And it's a threat to our environment. No matter whether you believe global warming is going to happen rapidly or happen in the far distant future, in very, very local ways, we all have experienced local smog, local air quality degrading, and I think that that is something that we all can do a much better job at solving by making better personal choices, just based on awareness of the fact that energy consumption really contributes to a variety of ills if we don't do it efficiently.
What kind of a time frame are we looking at to really start to see progress?
I think the time to make progress is literally right now. Every time that we make a decision to get a more efficient automobile or to use the automobiles we have in a more efficient way, it contributes to the solution. I think looking at things like renewable energy sources, becoming aware of things, it's a fancy term, but it's simple in its concept, renewable portfolio standards. That's simply a demand that can be placed on a utility company that a certain percentage of the electricity they supply to our homes comes from renewable sources like wind or biomass or photovoltaic solar type of electricity. And that will increase the ability of the industry in the renewable energy area to meet some of this demand. We cannot, in the near term, expect to replace a huge amount of our fossil fuel energy requirements with renewables, but for every percent of energy that is produced for electricity or for transportation by renewables, that's 1% less that we are dependent on oil and dependent on foreign oil.
As you look out into the long term, 5, 10, 20 years, where do you see America's energy sources coming from at that point?
We will continue to use oil, but I see a greater proportion coming from renewables. I mentioned some of them, solar power, wind power. We've been doing hydroelectric power for many, many years. Biomass, bioethanol. There's a technology that is coming online now to use certain enzymes to be able to break down what were previously unusable parts of plant structures, vegetation structures, to produce ethanol, and that's called cellulosic ethanol. And all of these renewable sources will be coming more and more into vogue and into availability for consumer choices. I think in the energy efficiency arena, we'll see much more progress in more energy efficient appliances under the Energy Star program. We'll see much greater use of such things as ground source heat pumps to heat and cool our homes, better insulation, not just for the usual attic insulation or window insulation, but indeed the whole structure of homes. And I see a whole variety of technologies that aren't around the corner, but literally are here today available to consumers that will have an increasingly greater effect. One of the things, though, that we all should be aware of is that right now, as we speak, there is a debate going on in the House of Representatives and U.S. Congress here in Washington, and it's about the energy bill. And one of the things that very, very greatly concerns me is there's about $3 billion of subsidies that are going to oil and gas companies in that bill that incentivizes exactly the wrong behavior. It's really important that our elected representatives in Congress stop incentivizing oil and gas companies that are making enormous profits at $55 a barrel oil from giving them tax incentives. Those tax incentives ought to be applied to the industries that are producing energy efficiency and renewable energy, energy from sources that are different than oils and natural gas sources. And I think that that is a great place to start in really, really turning the tide on our energy dependency. We were able to do tremendous things in the 1970s after the first oil embargo, and we can increase our performance, increase our energy efficiency, greatly increase our use of renewable energies if we have the right kind of national policy and the right kind of law.
In terms of the Defense Department itself and the vast defense expenditures, do you see movement there? Because there is that could be a leading edge in terms of creating some of these new technologies, really developing them.
Absolutely. The Department of Energy is getting increasingly active in this area of, in particular, energy efficiency, but also renewable energies. For example, there was a report that was published by the Rocky Mountain Institute in September of last year called Winning the Oil Endgame. It's a terrific report. It's available free online at rmi.org, and it basically tells us how over a period of 25 to 30 years that we can eliminate our dependence on oil and greatly increase our national security in the process. The Department of Defense funded over 50% of the cost of producing that report, and I think it's clear evidence that they are keenly interested in this aspect of national security.
Vice Admiral Dennis McGinn, I want to thank you so much for your voice. I'll tell you what, it's a refreshing, wonderful, positive, hopeful perspective, and I so much thank you for sharing that on the Wild Side News.
Thank you. We can meet this challenge. We just need to become aware of what the great tools that are available to do it, and we can win this, America.
Let's win it.
Take care.
Thanks so much. There is no more pressing national security issue for America and ultimately the world than quickly and collectively developing a world that lives on renewable energy. Wow, we just won the debate. When we return, we remember many of those who have shared their thoughts on the Wild Side News. When your voice of the earth continues, we'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Over the past few months, the Wild Side News has presented a big picture of the new players in this new energy vision. You're up to date about the state of the oceans. You've been introduced to a solar technology that can change the world. You've been introduced to the captains of the clean tech movement. And when you head on into the archives, you see the amazing friends of all that Earth Day 35 represents. When we return, we put it all together. So get ready for the real New World Order marching towards peace and stability and a healthy, hope-filled world for us all here on the Wild Side News. Most everyone loves our land and the wild creatures. We value clean air and clear vistas for our visions to roam. We want to get along with our neighbors and with the world. Let's be honest. What is most encouraging is that America is united now for our own good, to get to work, to invest, to build, to reconstruct, to invent and forge a new American dream. It has come together, and it will serve us all so well. So, to celebrate this moment, I want to bring us all some of the voices of the earth that have helped to make this all possible. So now, from the voice of the earth on the Wild Side News, a tribute to wisdom.
Hello, everyone. We're celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, and I might start with what is it? What it is really kind of takes an arrow back to Senator Mathias and what he did. He established a bipartisan effort to create a vision that would really preserve sections of land that are so powerful, and that we have for years and years and years been using them kind of like slogans for how we identify the best of ourselves. And the beauty and the power of our natural places has always held a kind of symbolic place for Americans. So we should be protecting these areas for future generations to preserve something that really does bind us together. What that something is the love of our country's incomparable public land. What we do preserve as much as what we develop is going to define us as a people and really basically as a society in perpetuity.
Kathleen Rogers, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you so much.
I want to invite you to greet our listeners and share your thoughts for this very special Earth Day 2004.
Well, I'm very happy to be on, and thank you so much for inviting me. It's a very exciting day, and I think your listeners can be proud of the fact that as environmentalists or as people who care about the Earth, they are joining together today with at least 500 million to 600 million people who are also participating in Earth Day in over 170 countries.
What happens on a river cleanup?
What happens on a river cleanup? It can be anything as from a small group doing a shoreline along a parking lot of a campground or something, and then we have other groups who actually get in the water in canoes and rafts and pull just about anything that's not supposed to be there. They try to pull back out tires, paper cups, tin cans, that sort of thing. And we send them tips on how to organize their cleanup, safety tips, press releases on how to get press for it so that they can turn out some more volunteers. And we really don't dictate how they should conduct their cleanup, but we try to guide them along as what they need to do.
Hot's been there for me. I've had, a couple bad weeks where I couldn't do anything just because of pain levels, and he would sit right there by my side. He's almost gotten to the point where he can anticipate my needs, even when I'm, physically down and unable to do much. If I want to go to the refrigerator to get something out for supper, he knows that that's where I'm headed, and he opens that door for me. We get out and I'm getting tired or something, he moves just a little bit closer and positions himself so I can grab his harness, like he's ready for me to pull, or for him to pull me. He's bonded with me much more than I ever thought was possible.
One British captain, a Captain Codrington, actually said, he predicted, there will be many busted heads in Baltimore before nightfall. And I think that shows the attitude of at least some of the British officers involved in this. The British ships got within range of the fort's guns. One eyewitness said it sounded like thunder when the fort's cannons fired. They were fired in such rapid succession.
Wow.
And the Baltimoreans went on the rooftops. We have a lot of letters, people saying that they were on the roof of the Holiday Street Theater, which is today City Hall. We also have letters of other people squirming out, you know, and climbing on the rooftops. And they said you could see the smoke curling up over the fort and the flashes of the fort's guns in the midst of the smoke.
Vince?
And, yeah.
Boy, do you like your work?
Just a little bit. No, I love my work.
I know, it's so obvious.
I love my work.
You're a fabulous interpreter. And we didn't even have a chance to really talk about the rest of the park, but I'll tell you what, Vince is the best invitation to visit Fort McHenry in Maryland that I can imagine.
Well, American Hiking Society was formed in 1977 to be a national voice for America's hikers. And then as a part of our outreach in promoting and protecting foot trails and the hiking experience, 12 years ago, we joined up with several key partners on the federal side, the National Park Service, the Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, and with Backpacker Magazine to launch National Trails Day. And then very shortly thereafter, Thorlow Fox came in as well to support this program. And what it is a national celebration of trails. All across the country, and actually we have events in every single state, one in Canada and three in Puerto Rico.
This is one of the most innovative, boundary-busting, and hope-filled realities for every person, and animal, and vista, and community, and nation on the planet. And here to tell you about it is one of the principals in the new hydrogen car company, Cole Freitas. Cole, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Cindy.
Let's lay it on the table here. You say you have a hydrogen-powered car. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, we have more than one car. And what we did is we announced several weeks ago that we had we are making available for sale Shelby Cobras that run off a hydrogen internal combustion engine, and those are for wealthy individuals, high-end users, celebrities, people who will get a lot of visibility, and we partnered up with Carroll Shelby to make those cars. But we also offer pickup trucks that are F-150s and Rangers that also run off internal combustion engines using hydrogen that are much more affordable and that are comparable or a little bit more expensive than F-150s and Rangers that are new and run off gasoline.
Really only 13% of the NPRA, which was the compromise that was worked out. Why is that so important in terms of this this area?
Well, just to highlight a few of the features, this area has very high-density nesting populations of the red-throated loons, the rare yellow-billed loon, common eiders, king eiders, long-tailed ducks, a number of shorebird species, and also populations of the threatened spectacle eider. This is a species that's actually listed under the Endangered Species Act as threatened. So those are birds that nest there. And then in the after breeding season, geese and many waterfowls molt their feathers, and when their wing feathers molt, they are actually flightless. And during that period of time, in July and a portion of August, these birds are very, very sensitive to any disturbance. They're very vulnerable because they can't fly. So they seek out the most valuable wetland complexes that have abundant food and low densities of predators and are very secluded. So the Teshikpuk Lake, and particularly the deep water lakes just north of Teshikpuk, between Teshikpuk Lake and the Arctic Ocean, that area is a very high value for molting geese, and is considered by most scientists as one of the most significant goose molting areas in the entire circumpolar Arctic.
Kilmeel, you look into his eyes and you get hooked. He's an animal, he's a bird, he's a hero. You look at him, you realize this is someone true, man. This is not some celebrity who would, you know, fool around with some prostitute somewhere and disappoint you somewhere. This is a bird, it's real. You look at him, you know there's no disappointment to come. He is a true hero. He's not a politician. He does his thing, you watch him, and you feel good deep inside of your heart. He is my hero. That is how I spend so much time on him. I take all my vacation I have. I just practically took time off from work indefinitely until this stuff is resolved. That's the kind of effect he has on me.
I think I'm going to start off by giving you a greeting in chimpanzee. That really means just, hello, I'm Jane. You know, that's how they greet the morning.
The king of Bhutan, because leadership, radical leadership, radical, intelligent, caring leadership is required. Talk about that wonderful story.
Well, the Bhutanese looked around at the world, and they're sandwiched between China and India, two of the biggest countries in the world, and they, the king of Bhutan, who was an absolute ruler, decided that A, he was going to give up his absolute power, which he did, and established a parliament, and they all got together, and it's an educated, by the way, it's their top educated people. They're not ignoramuses. The king of Bhutan is 10 times as smart as George Bush and 10 times as well educated. Said, we're going to not go for gross national product alone. We're going to go for gross national happiness. We're going to preserve our forests. We're going to preserve our culture, and the diversity of cultures is one of the wonders of humanity. And we're going to work at making our people all happy, healthy, well cared for, and in a wonderful environment. Whether they'll totally succeed or not is still an issue. They let TV in, which may have been a big mistake.
Floresta was founded about 20 years ago by a group of Americans and Dominicans who had been working together doing hurricane relief following Hurricane David. And they became frustrated in giving out basically food aid and handouts day in and day out without addressing any of the root causes. So they decided to dig a little deeper and see why people were unable to make a living for themselves. And came to the very interesting conclusion, and it's especially interesting when you consider kind of the who these people were and the presuppositions they went in with, but they came to the conclusion that deforestation was one of the key causes, one of the root causes of rural poverty in the Dominican Republic.
My sermon this morning is captioned, God's Love in Nature. And I want you to journey with me this morning back into time, a time called the beginning. An earth with a sound ecological system, well-balanced ecosystem, clean, pure environment. Yes, that was paradise. Oh, my friends, I could imagine all the Amazonas, every species in those days, none were extinct. As they beautified, as they adorned, the foliage or the flora with the lovely plumage. Oh, what a sight! Praise be to God!
And in 1991, I went to a Greenpeace rally for whales in Trafalgar Square. I was invited to be one of a group of celebrity speakers. And I had to talk about, I was given a piece to talk about long-range communication of whales across oceans and across many thousands of miles. And I was astonished at that because I had no idea that whales could do all these things. I, unlike a lot of people, had never heard the whale record. And because I think I was too busy doing Shakespeare or something at the time. But anyway, Roger Payne opened this rally for whales, and we met there at the rally, and we were married 10 weeks later. And when I met Roger, I remember writing that it was like standing on the shores of an ocean and the waves just rolling in, and somehow I knew that I was encountering and finally embracing a much bigger world than just the world of theatrical and film and television acting that I'd been involved with.
The indigenous people have had such a tremendous impact on me, as you know from my other five books, which are all about them. And without their help, without having seeing it from their side, I don't think I ever would have had the courage to write this book, and I don't think I ever would have had the heart to write the book, or the hope. The book is written out of a great sense of hope. When I wrote this book, I knew I was sticking my neck in the noose, and not suicidal or self-destructive. So I would only stick my neck in a noose if I had great hope that it was going to accomplish something positive. And the indigenous people, with all of their prophecies from so many different cultures, as I talk about in the book, they all prophesy. So many cultures prophesy that we're entered a time of potential for tremendous transition for human beings to rise to a new level of consciousness and relate to each other and the environment in very different ways. And I have complete hope that we will do that. And I realize that that has to start by a true recognition of where we've come from and where we stand right now today. And part of that recognition involves recognizing what economic hitmen have done, what we've all done, in essence, to create this empire.
Now let's bring it down to people. What in the world can they do to become part of this process?
I think between the scientific community, the aquarium, communicators, perhaps this New Earth Observing System will be able to put part of this continuous picture of this continuous diagnosis of the ocean onto the internet. I think actually the internet may be a tool for creating the globally connected behavior that we will need in order to arrive at a management of a global problem.
But I'm going to give you the opportunity to talk to the whole world and tell them your thoughts about what is most critical in the years ahead.
The solving the global environmental issues that we see gradually accumulating will require a degree of human cooperation and interconnectedness that has not yet been seen.
We're working on it.
So are we.
Connect up brains, hearts, and hold hands, and then indeed we can look forward to a better and a more peaceful future if we help each other, if we maintain hope. So that's the message I have for you. Never give up. There's always hope. Thanks.
I want to thank all of you for tuning in and joining in. We can look back on the struggle and know that we have been on message and right all along. Now we need to unite and move our planet forward for us, for our children, and for this magical mystery tour of life on our great little planet Earth. So until next time, or any time on the archives, this is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again on your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.